Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world. Online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
News Corp has MySpace. If Carl Icahn gets his way, Microsoft may have Yahoo. And today, in the latest virtual land grab, CBS says it's going to have CNET. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, serving their audit, tax, and advisory clients worldwide with people who love what they do. Online at grantthornton.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us today. It is Thursday, May the 15th. Its little slice of the web isn't going to come cheap for CBS. The sticker price on CNET is $1.8 billion. That's a hefty 45% more than the company's stock was worth at the opening bell this morning. It's not hard to see why the sale makes sense for CNET. It's a pre-dot-com bubble icon that's run into some trouble of late. We asked Stacey Vanek-Smith to find out what's in the deal for CBS.
CNET just reported a $6 million loss, and it's been battling dissident shareholders. So why would CBS pay such a premium for the tech news giant? Porter Bibb is with MediaTek Capital Partners.
This was a kind of Murdochian offer you can't refuse, the way he came at Dow Jones with his $5.2 billion offer.
The deal will make CBS the 10th largest internet network on the web. CNET owns dozens of sites like ZDNet and GameSpot and pulls in more than 105 million visitors a day. It also owns the Boardwalk and Park Place of online real estate, URLs like news.com, download.com, and tv.com. Bibb says CNET will dramatically expand CBS's reach.
They also are extremely well positioned in Europe and in Asia, particularly in China. They've been in China for nearly 10 years.
Bibb says if CBS had offered less, the deal might have gotten drawn out, Yahoo Microsoft style, with other companies making bids. Still, CBS bought itself a pretty expensive insurance policy, says industry analyst Rob Enderle.
This offer from CBS seems to be a very, very generous offer, given CNET's performance of late.
Enderle says other tech news sites are doing a better job of covering the industry for a lot less money. But for CBS, buying an internet audience is easier than building one. Jeff Jarvis teaches journalism at City University of New York.
This is a long tradition of big companies trying to buy their future. And I'm not sure it works.
Jarvis says this could be a mini AOL Time Warner disaster in the making. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
There aren't many companies bigger or more iconic than General Electric, but CEO Jeffrey Immelt apparently wants to downsize some. Word is GE's selling off its appliance unit. The company wouldn't confirm the reports when we called them. Of course, they didn't deny it either. Appliances are just a sliver of GE's profits, but first quarter earnings, you might remember, came in way worse than expected, so something kind of had to give. And if a bellwether like GE is struggling, what's it like out there for everybody else? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
When we read about the things those research people at General Electric are working on,
there's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow.
Things looked pretty good when GE made that presentation at the 1964 World's Fair. But now shareholders don't think Tomorrowland looks all that great. In the name of progress toward a higher stock price, they want GE to peel away some of its layers. Quincy Crosby is chief investment strategist at The Hartford. She says with a weak economy and falling profits, more and more companies will come under this kind of pressure. Crosby says it's not unusual for shareholders to force CEOs to do a little spring cleaning during economic slowdowns.
Take a look at where they're doing well, where they're not doing well, and basically telling CEOs to stick to their knitting, stick to what they're good at.
Crosby says even tight-knit companies can expect to hear demands to unravel underperforming assets. But will troubled divisions sell in a weak economy? Yes, because of the weak dollar.
With the decline in the dollar, the United States is basically having a 20% off sale.
David Weiss is chief economist at Standard & Poor's.
Well, the bottom line to the stockholder is the share price. And if those foreign buyers are offering attractive share prices, management's going to be under a lot of pressure to accept the deals.
Companies from China, South Korea, and Germany are said to be interested in GE's appliance division. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Although rescue has largely turned to recovery in China, there is still a race against time, this one against water. Army troops have been dispatched to shore up nearly 400 dams that were damaged by the earthquake. Mother Nature is mostly to blame, but there are worries over human error, too, because Marketplace's Scott Tong reports from Shanghai that China is increasingly exporting its dam-building expertise.
Sichuan province is blessed with mountains and rivers, the key ingredients for hydropower. But it's also cursed for sitting on a major fault line. Aviva Imhoff of the environmental group International Rivers says Chinese scientists warned Beijing 8 years ago about the danger. Her broader criticism is of Chinese construction standards.
Sometimes the quality of the cement is not at the level that it's required to be. Contractors often cut corners to line their own pockets. It makes the structures a lot more vulnerable.
That quality question has plagued many of China's 22,000 dams. And this has now become a global issue, since Beijing is now exporting its services.
We are seeing a huge influx in massive dam projects around the world. There's a huge amount of capital from emerging economies to invest in these projects. And China has become, over the past 5 years, the world's largest dam builder.
Imhoff says a Chinese firm building a dam in Laos showed such shoddy erosion control standards it was fired. Still, organizations like the Asian Development Bank say in many cases hydropower is safe and it's economically justified. Countries that generate and export water-based power can earn valuable foreign reserves and lift millions out of poverty. It's a contentious debate. Once again, it's current as Chinese rescuers try to hold back the water. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
A late rally on Wall Street today lifted stocks. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The first regularly scheduled flight in a week landed at the airport in Beirut, Lebanon this afternoon. Negotiators have announced a deal to end a week of fighting that killed more than 80 people. In the 30 years since the Lebanese civil war started, violence has become almost a way of life there, for residents and for businesses too, as Ben Gilbert reports now from West Beirut.
My neighborhood is called Hamra. Churches sit across the street from mosques. In this area with Christians, Sunni and Shiite Muslims, Druze and foreigners, all living together. Hamra Street is kind of the main street of Beirut. It's lined with clothing and jewelry shops, bookstores, and a Starbucks, a Radio Shack, and dozens of small hotels.
How's business?
The business is bad.
This is Tariq, the assistant manager at the Mayflower Hotel in Hamra. I've known him since I first came to Beirut in 2005. I use the hotel's occupancy as one of my indicators as to how the country's doing. Today, 17 of the hotel's 80 rooms are taken, and half of the guests are journalists, which Tariq says is not a good sign.
Somehow it's like it's an indicator that something bad will happen. Because when you see journalists, they're coming from everywhere, from Norway, from the States, from UK, from everywhere, from China, let's say, this means that there's something will happen.
Hamra was the most cosmopolitan neighborhood in town before Lebanon's 15-year civil war began in 1975. The area never fully recovered. But just in the last few months, Hamra had begun to undergo a renaissance.
Even the glory days of Lebanon, you know, Hamra was the place to be.
Waleed Itaya is the head of the slow food movement in Beirut. He opened a hip artisanal bakery called Bread Republic.
It's the only formal shopping street in Lebanon where you have a wide street, wide sidewalk. So it's the heart of the city, actually.
In the last few months, half a dozen new restaurants opened here, and a sushi place was on the way. But last Thursday and Friday, bullets struck Bread Republic's outdoor tables when Hezbollah gunmen and their opposition allies overran this neighborhood. Bullet casings littered the street, and militiamen lurked where I had eaten lunch that afternoon. It was May 9th.
On the 9th, it was a war zone over here, and it was full of Hezbollah people, and I got 20 meters away from the shop, and they start shooting, so I left. I went to my friend's place and came back at 4.
The next day, Bread Republic was one of the few cafes open on the usually bustling street, even though army personnel carriers rumbled by to try to keep the peace. Marwan says he's open out of necessity, and unfortunately, he's done all this before.
We have to pay our bills at the end of the day. We have to pay our wages and stuff like that. We Lebanese, I don't want to say we got used to this, but we can manage our way around those situations.
Like other businessmen, Ataya has his own indicators for when he should open or close. These days, he shuts his door before the sun goes down and militiamen start roaming the streets. The flow of traffic and the neighborhood chatter are also good weather vanes. But he says his best indicator is his gut, paying attention to the mood on the street to get a heads up if the fighting is about to start again. In Beirut, I'm Ben Gilbert for Marketplace.
The second leg of horse racing's Triple Crown, the Preakness, is Saturday at the Pimlico Racecourse in Baltimore, Maryland. The Maryland Jockey Club, which hosts the race, says sponsorship this year is down 10% and that businesses are watching their pennies and pulling back. Commentator and tax attorney Conrad Tytel says if your horse comes in, you better watch your wallet.
And in the home stretch, it's Uncle Sam coming up on the taxpayers. If your horse comes in, your winnings are taxable. Also taxable, by the way, are winnings from poker, blackjack, roulette, craps, slots, bingo. You get the picture. While winnings are clearly taxable, are losses deductible? To deduct losses, you'll have to jump through more hoops than a circus pony. Losses are deductible only against other gambling income in the same year. They can't be used to offset taxable income from non-gambling activities. And, unless you're a regular on the World Poker Tour or a professional gambler, your losses are deductible against winnings only if you itemize. Proving losses is tough. You need to keep a log showing winnings and losses. Detail all bets, dates, places, and the gambling activities. Sometimes that does the trick, but it's often a long shot. Consider this sob story that John Greer told the IRS. Greer was in the horse racing business and owned a mare, Princess of Erin. She delivered a foal that Greer planned to race. The little guy was born after the normal 11-month gestation period, but lived only 5 days. Greer conceded that the nice payment he got from the insurance company was taxable. However, he considered the foal a capital asset held for more than 6 months. That was the required holding period at the time for favorable long-term capital gains rates. Greer claimed a holding period of 11 months and 5 days. It started, he maintained, from the date of conception. Greer had to pay the higher ordinary income tax. An appeals court ruled that the gain was short-term. The mare's holding period was 11 months. Greer's was only 5 days. So what's the morning line on your bottom line? Hang your horseshoe with the ends pointing up so your luck doesn't fall out. And then for you, it just might be a horse of a different color.
Conrad Tytel is a tax attorney in Connecticut. Send us your thoughts no matter where you are. Go to marketplace.org, click on that link that says contact. Coming up, preserving the past with modern cash.
I'm making big changes here, and I need money. And this money that I'm making from the replica, it is not for Egypt to be rich. No, it's to use.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 0.7% today, 94 points to close at 12,992. The NASDAQ gained nearly 1.5%, 37 points to close at 2,533. The S&P 500 finished up 1%, 14 points. 1423 was the close. CNET soared 43% on the news today that CBS is going to buy the web media company for $1.8 billion. CBS shares lost 2.3% on that same news. Funny how that happens, isn't it? We told you about that report that GE might sell its appliance division. The company's stock drifted down nearly 0.5%. Today, Tiffany rose more than 6% after the jewelry company dazzled investors with a sparkling 13% boost to its dividend. Bonds traded up. Yields on 10-year T-notes fell to 3.82%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for April. FBI Director Robert Mueller is at the National Press Club. He'll talk about the challenges of protecting public safety and civil rights in the era of international terrorism. And depending on where you live, you may be taking your life in your hands, but there is power in numbers. It's National Bike to Work Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl with this test of your commodities market savvy. If you wanted to trade steel futures, where could you go? London is an option. India and Dubai offer steel contracts, too. If you're looking to keep your money in this country, though, you're out of luck for just a little while longer anyway. The New York Mercantile Exchange announced today it's going to start trading steel by the end of the year. That market interest is one solid reflection of rising steel prices. Corporate profits are another one. American steel companies are booking record earnings, as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
The cheap dollar and overseas demand are pumping new life into an old domestic industry. Robert Griggs is the president of St. Louis-based Trinity Products, which sells steel construction materials and signs around the country, and now Canada as well.
I've met with people recently from Saudi Arabia, from Turkey, from Greece. I've gotten lots of quotes from people asking us to make material around the world, so I think we could become a steel exporter.
Over the last 10 years, 40 or 50 steel companies went bankrupt. But Scott Paul of the Alliance for American Manufacturing says good times are here again.
We've seen about 18 months of prosperity for steel, but that comes on the back of about three decades of bloodletting.
The outlook should be rosy for a while, since steel users have few alternatives. Besides, prices for aluminum and plastics are also going up. But Scott Paul says the profits are attracting lots of new suppliers.
In fact, China has brought on about 400 million metric tons of new steel capacity just over the last couple of years. And if there's a worldwide economic downturn, and if demand in China and other countries decreases, we're going to see a glut of overcapacity.
In the meantime, steel's high price will show up in consumer prices for cars, appliances, and cell phone service. Even steel cell phone towers cost more. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Legendary oil man T. Boone Pickens made a big bet on energy today. Interestingly enough, one that has nothing at all to do with hydrocarbons. Pickens is going to spend $8 billion on wind. He announced plans to build the world's biggest wind farm in a place called Pampa, Texas. And he did it without knowing whether he's going to get some help from the tax man. Congress is considering an extension of clean energy tax credits. They give homeowners and businesses a break in return for installing more expensive renewable systems. But those credits expire at the end of the year, which is leaving clean energy companies in the dark. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Danielle Carson reports.
Workers at Standard Solar are loading residential solar panels into the company truck. The D.C. area firm is making more of them than ever. A big reason why is federal tax credits that go to buyers of the panels. But company president Tony Clifford says Congress's lack of a long-term policy is short-circuiting potential business.
For larger commercial installations, which might take several months or a year or more of planning, how can you expect them to get the lending guarantees that they need to make the project work if there's no guarantee long-term that the tax credit is going to be there? So they'll never start the project.
Right now, hundreds of projects across the country are hanging by a thread, according to Michael Eckert with the American Council on Renewable Energy. He says they represent the equivalent of what 40 nuclear power plants generate.
All the projects that are lining up for financing to be developed or put into place in 2009 have to wait until we really know. Do we have a production tax credit for wind power and geothermal and biomass? Do we have an investment tax credit for solar energy and fuel cells or not?
Now, some of those projects may disappear altogether. Overseas investors would love to bankroll green technology projects here because the U.S. market has been white hot. But Eckert says investors aren't willing to wait forever.
They're building their factories elsewhere where the markets are more stable. They'll build the factory twice as big so they can export from Spain, from Australia, from China to the U.S. market when it does get turned on.
In Europe and Asia, renewable energy is already a major part of the electricity mix. Germany's cornered solar energy. China is taking the lead in wind turbines. All this makes Janine Sargent wince. The CEO of Oerlikon Corporation, a global maker of solar systems, says the U.S. has pioneered many technologies, only to lose out to foreign producers because of erratic federal policies.
Flat panel display and large screen TVs was a technology that was innovated in the United States, and the manufacturing and the operation and sales of that is outside of the United States. I do not want to see solar suffer that same edge.
Ron Resch with the Solar Energy Industry Association says sales are already dropping off.
If we're going to get serious about reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, these technologies have to make up a major portion of our electricity mix going forward.
Even if Congress approves the tax credit extensions, Resch says the delay is already derailing large-scale solar projects. He says Congress's glacial pace could cost $19 billion in economic investment in wind, geothermal, and solar technologies. And nearly 120,000 green jobs could dry up between now and next year. In Washington, I'm Danielle Carson for Marketplace.
President's in the Middle East this week. He's been making the rounds with Israeli leaders. He gave a big speech in the Knesset this morning. Tomorrow it's off to Saudi Arabia and then Egypt on Saturday. The subtext of the whole trip has been the White House and the fate of the Palestinians. Less contentious have been the president's visits to assorted historic sites and museums. In Egypt, though, museums are very much a divisive issue over the question of who owns the past. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from Cairo.
You may have seen Zahi Hawass promoting Egypt on the Discovery Channel in his signature Indiana Jones hat.
My job, I'm in charge of all Egypt antiquities.
Hawass is head of Egypt's Supreme Council of Antiquities. He's an archaeologist charged with safeguarding the country's cultural heritage. Hawass has been battling the St. Louis Art Museum to return a 3,200-year-old mask he says was stolen from a storage room. And he's campaigning to bring five major pieces back to Egypt, at least temporarily. Pieces like the Rosetta Stone from the British Museum and the bust of Nefertiti from Berlin. If the museums don't comply, Hawass is threatening what he calls scientific action.
They excavate in Egypt, they restore in Egypt, they take photographs, they do things, we'll tell them no. If you don't cooperate with us, we will not cooperate with you.
Thousands of ancient treasures have left Egypt over the centuries. Many were carted away by archaeologists with official blessings. Others were smuggled out and sold on the black market. To stem the trade, Zahi Hawass has proposed stiffer penalties for smugglers. He's also floated the idea of copywriting Egyptian artifacts. The royalties would help pay for more than a dozen new museums under construction in Egypt.
I'm making big changes here, and I need money. And this money that I'm making from the replica, it is not for Egypt to be rich. No, it's to use in restoring these monuments that I believe it does not belong to Egypt only, but belongs to everyone all over the world.
That's just the point, says James Cuno, who directs the Art Institute of Chicago. He's written a book, Who Owns Antiquity? Aside from sheer geography, Cuno says modern Egypt's link to the pharaonic civilization is tenuous.
You know, it's not in the religious practice, it's not in the language, it's not in the artistic practice, not in the way, any political relationships.
And he says claiming otherwise is dangerous.
Culture is something that always is a very fluid and mongrel thing that is made by people and not by nations. And to put political borders around culture is to falsify the history of culture as we know it.
Yet the past is one of Egypt's biggest moneymakers. Tourists who flocked to the pyramids and the Valley of the Kings brought in some $8 billion last season. Hani El-Masri is an Egyptian artist. He'd like to see the Rosetta Stone stay right where it is.
I think these pieces are our best ambassadors all over the world, and they are enticing people to come and visit Egypt to see the source of all this wonderful work.
El-Masri says he'd rather see Egypt restore its place as a cultural leader. The country is plagued by poverty, unemployment, and political unrest.
We can't claim that we are the inheritance of these pieces until we really deserve to be the inheritance.
The century-old Egyptian Museum in Cairo is packed with more than 120,000 statues, sarcophagi, and other treasures. Relics shoved into corners and stacked on top of each other would be worthy of a national exhibition just about any place else in the world. But museum director Wafa El-Sadiq prefers it this way. When King Tutankhamun's tomb was discovered in 1922, it was stuffed to the gills.
This is the way you find the tomb, crowded. So ancient Egypt was very rich, and the museum was very rich because of that.
Within a few years, all that could change. The famous King Tut's burial finery will be moved to the new Grand Museum near the Giza Pyramids, complete with IMAX theater and fancy new exhibits. And if Zahi Hawass has his way, lost treasures from the museums of Europe and the United States will be there for the opening. In Cairo, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final thought before we go today, I got all cute last week introducing a story about the stimulus package and its tax rebates. I said the check is in the mail. Turns out that's not entirely true. The IRS said today as many as 350,000 households didn't get their entire amount, specifically the $300 per child they were supposed to get. The agency says, and this is them now, not me, that the checks will be in the mail by July. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 94.7%. The NASDAQ added 37 points, nearly 1.5%. The S&P 500 rose 14.1%. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, the rebirth of an 80s boy band.
With some of us were like, oh my God, we kind of reverted back to being 15, that excitement again about the group, and something, it doesn't go away.
Oh my goodness. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.